Our guest for the next 2 hours, Nigel Watson, has written for numerous magazines on paranormal subjects such as Wired, History Today, Flying Saucer Review, and UFO Magazine. He is the author of 5 books, UFOs of the First World War, The Alien Deception, The Scareship Mystery, Supernatural Spielberg, and Portraits of Alien Encounters. Tonight, we'll talk about his new book due out in May, UFOs of the First World War. Nigel Watson, our guest, here on Coast to Coast AM. UFOs of the First World War, phantom airships, balloons, aircraft, and other mysterious aerial phenomena. That's the book due out May 1st by Nigel Watson. This evening, we're going to discuss the book. We'll discuss UFOs. And if you have questions for our guest, we will encourage you to call us in the next hour when we open up phone lines. Welcome to Coast AM, Nigel Watson. Good evening, Nigel. Thank you for joining us.
Right. Hello. Good to be here.
I guess I should say good morning to you, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us here this evening. Now, I wanted to start off one thing that was kind of interesting to me when this book was brought to my attention, just so happened to coincide with an article that was released a few weeks ago as well about a reported encounter between the famous Red Baron possibly having shot down a UFO. And I wanted to touch base with you about this article and see what your thoughts were on it. If you could tell us a little bit about the story, the encounter as it has been shared, and if you know if there's any legitimacy to it.
Okay, well, the case of a Red Baron is probably the most sensational case in the book, but it's probably the weakest in terms of evidence and credibility, really. The story is that the Red Baron was flying on a mission over Western Belgium in the spring of 1917 when he encountered a craft that looked like an upside-down saucer that was about 136 feet in diameter. It had undulating orange lights on it. This craft suddenly appeared and I suppose with Red Baron's lightning reflexes, he immediately shot it down, as you do. And the craft, apparently, according to this account, fell like a rock and sheared off limbs of trees as it crashed into some woods. And then the pilot accompanying the Red Baron said that two bruised and battered occupants seemed to get out of the crashed object and run away into the woods. Also, according to this account, they reported it back at headquarters, but it was never mentioned again. And then the main thought was that it was a secret US aircraft at the time, because the Americans had just joined the war in April 1917. So that's what the thought it was. And then in the 1940s, when flying saucers hit the headlines, he felt that that's what explains the object they saw. But this was an account given by a person in something like 1999, and it was reported in the Weekly World News, which isn't the best source of information. And also, people have since found that the type of aircraft that he allegedly flew at the time wasn't one that the Red Baron was flying at that time. There's quite a few other flaws to the story. But the story has kind of circulated on and off for quite a time since 1999, really. And I think that's a problem with a lot of these accounts of events that happened allegedly during the First World War, is that it's a reported, decades later. Obviously, lots of errors can creep in, even if, you know, something was seen at the time. It's difficult to actually report a case that's only a few hours old, let alone something that's, this literally, 50 plus years,
Was it when you researching for a book like this, as you just mentioned, it's hard to, you know, recount something that just happened a few hours ago or a few weeks ago, to dig back and find actual accounts that date back to World War One, which a lot of people, you know, may not even realize. What was it? The first real flight was December 17th, 1903. So. Yeah. World War One, just, you know, not too many years after that here, for there to be craft in the sky that is moving faster than what we knew existed and was able to, you know, confuse the pilots of the time and flights. By World War Two, we know about the many classic cases. I guess I didn't realize that going back to World War One, there were also these famous stories. How hard was it to research this type of material?
Well, a lot of cases Well, a few cases were reported in newspapers, so you do get a few accounts, but obviously, say, most of the newspapers in Europe were censored at that time, so you didn't always get a lot of information in those reports. But a colleague of mine, Granville Odroyd, he went to the public record offices in London, and he found in the archives literally hundreds of accounts of strange lights seen in the sky during the First World War that were reported to the British police. And all these reports were passed on to the War Office, where they were investigated by a couple of officers, basically, who reviewed the material. And if they thought the cases were of sufficient quality, would, you know, ask for further reports. But a lot of these sightings were just of, you know, lights in the sky. But a lot of them also occurred at the very beginning of the war, after August 1914, basically, because people expected German zeppelins to be attacking immediately. But as it happened, real German zeppelins didn't attack Britain until January 1915. So anything before then was likely to have just, you know, a lot of it was figments of the imagination, really, or you know, it could be anything, really. I suppose it's something we'd call, you know, UFO cases, you know, today. And there were so many sightings that they even searched remote locations in Scotland, looking for bases that might be supporting aircraft activities. But obviously such a base would have to have quite a good storage facilities and supplies of petrol and personnel, really, to maintain even the simplest aircraft, because at that time aircraft were really high maintenance, and you know, they obviously needed them. You know, their engines often weren't very satisfactory and needed a constant, you know, repair and maintenance. So, but there were so many sightings, they even offered something like £100 reward for anyone who could give information about finding any base like that. Which was a lot of money then, you know. Wages were something like £1 or £2 a week, you know. So, you know, it's like a year's wages if you found something like that. But in lots of areas of Scotland, there were lots of rumours of aircraft flying about, but it's hard to actually pin them down. Some of these sightings, like one in 1914, the defences of London were always looking out for aircraft or zeppelins, and one sighting had tragic consequences in September 1914. The Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve used to send up a small captive balloon that would ascend to about a height of about 500 feet to look out for anything. And one night in September 14, one of the observers signaled that he'd observed a large hostile airship approaching London at a rapid pace with red, green, and yellow lights. So we immediately sent up a pilot to look for this, but he couldn't. The pilot couldn't see anything, but when he attempted to land, he crashed and killed himself. So, so in a way, this was one of the first UFO reports to actually, have a tragic consequence. As it happened, the balloon observer later signaled to say that the lights of what he thought was an airship was really the Star Vega, and that, so in a way, the pilot had been sent up on a wild goose chase and sort of paid for it with his life. So that was sort of parallels with the famous Thomas Mantle case in the USA in the 50s, where again, he chased what some people think was a secret balloon or Venus or, others say is a UFO. I think the interesting thing with this particularly...
But isn't it kind of ridiculous to say that he was sent up to chase Venus or a celestial, star cluster? That doesn't move at any kind of rate or speed that people would be able to physically notice in the air.
Yeah, well, actually, the observer said it was approaching London at a rapid pace.
Right.
Flashing red, green, and yellow lights. That doesn't really match with the explanation of it being a star. So there again, there's different, opinions there, really. I suppose for a skeptic, it's quite handy to say, oh, yeah, it was just a star and move on. But obviously, there is a bit more to this. I think it is difficult, though, with sightings during wartime, because obviously, there was a lot of fear of what might happen, because, as you said earlier, aircraft technology was very, very new, and there were always, people were fearful of what they could do. People thought that German Zeppelins would completely destroy London, and, that would, quickly enable Germany to invade Britain, because we had no real defence against them. As it happened, though, German Zeppelins were weren't particularly a great weapon, because they could be easily shot down. They're a huge, slow-moving target.
And flammable, right?
Yeah, flammable. And also, even when they were on the ground, wind can blow them about, so they had a lot of trouble handling them on the ground, so they were easily destroyed. On takeoff or landing, and also the British bombed their the airship bases, so that were kind of a sitting duck, really. But that didn't stop people fearing them. In fact, they did bomb Britain on several occasions, causing a few hundred fatalities. So, I think in terms of numbers, it wasn't significant compared to the huge, thousands of people being killed on the Western Front. But on the other hand, it was a great propaganda weapon for the Germans, and the image of a huge Zeppelin with beams of light shining on the countryside or over London was very potent. So I think that it struck fear into people. And like I said, there were, investigations throughout the land into this matter. And obviously, militarily sensitive areas were particularly prone to having sightings of aircraft or Zeppelins coming over. There's even instances of people saying that they heard powerful motor cars driving down the roads with bright headlights, which were thought were directing Zeppelins to their targets. And other people thought people were, signalling on hilltops to Zeppelins. So, and also these were linked to stories of, spies breaking into places and phantom snipers shooting at troop trains and things like that. So there's quite a lot of strange things going on. I suppose a lot of the spying activity can be related to today with, you know, stories of men in black.
Right.
And, you know, them driving around in sort of shiny new cars.
Well, you brought up something interesting. You said that, you know, they thought, especially with the craft that maybe the Red Baron did encounter, that it might have been something from the U.S., a secret spy plane or a secret craft. Doesn't that seem to kind of almost debunk itself? Because if that were, in fact, the truth, and the United States did have that kind of air superiority, wouldn't that war have been won much quicker? I mean, that was the whole idea behind Hitler's advancement of wanting to use the UFO technology and creating craft like that, because once you command the air, you command the war.
Exactly. There was another set of rumors that kind of follow on almost from the Red Baron one, was that they thought there were what were the British called, Lady Sopworth encounters. One pilot was flying on patrol in 1918 when he saw an identical aircraft to his own, a biplane, and it was flying alongside him. And he said he saw this female pilot who had a cascade of golden hair, wearing goggles, who was waving and throwing kisses at him. And the aircraft then went flying off really fast, and she went so fast that she lost track of him very quickly. And observers on the ground were also supposed to have seen this encounter between the two aircraft. And when he reported it, his squadron leader thought he would start raving mad. But this was the start of a legend of the Lady Sopworth. And apparently in January, a few months later, a German pilot said he'd been shot down by a female pilot who he called the Valkyrie. And it says then several German aviators apparently encountered this Red Sopwith triplane piloted by a woman who shot them down. And apparently this aircraft outflew every other aircraft in the sky and shot down dozens of enemy aircraft, and it sparked off a rumor of a squadron of sort of Valkyrie shooting down aircraft. And one of the rumors, like both sides seem to have this legend of the female squadron, and one of the theories was that one of the aircraft was being flown by the sister of a Red Baron to seek revenge for his death. So it neatly fits in with the other Red Baron story of shooting down a UFO, really. So I think it's quite interesting, though, that this is another set of stories of, you know, incredible aircraft coming to shoot people down. And, you know, like you say, if anybody had superior aircraft, it'd soon dominate the skies and change the whole direction of a war. But I think with the Sopwith story in particular, I think it just shows the sort of rumours that might occur, really. And I think also they'll probably improve with a retelling. There again, I think that's another problem, that over time people have wartime memories that, you know, add more to the original story.
Our guest for the next hour and a half, we have with us Nigel Watts, and we're talking about his book. It'll be out on May 1st. You can go order it now on Amazon.com. UFOs of the First World War, Phantom Airships, Balloons, Aircraft, and Other Mysterious Aerial Phenomena. Was there something to this? Could it be that they did have alien shot down craft? Is that why the Nazi scientists were so far advanced with the UFO technology and rocket technology that we ended up purloining from them after the war? We'll talk more with our guest about that right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Much has been said that after the Roswell crash, the reported Roswell crash, the amount of back engineering, the amount of new technology that burst forth on the market was astounding. Could that have been what happened during World War I with the alleged UFO sightings? Did the Nazis actually procure some sort of downed craft? Is that why their scientists were so far ahead of us when it came to the rocket and spaceship technology? We'll talk with our guest, Nigel Watson. He's here talking with us about his book, UFOs of the First World War, Phantom Airships, Balloons, Aircraft, and Other Mysterious Aerial Phenomena. We'll discuss that and so much more right here on the best in overnight talk radio. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader, and you're listening to Coast AM. For links to our guests this evening, go check out coasttocoastam.com. You can find links to our guests' websites and their books. You can pre-order our guest's book, UFOs of the First World War. It'll be out on May 1st, 2015. Nigel, I'm just curious what your thoughts are. Do you believe that it was all of these reports of strange flying craft during World War I that fueled Hitler's interest in the idea of UFO technology and air superiority?
I think that it must have been a factor. Before I was saying how potent an image it was of a German Zeppelins, because in the years leading up to the First World War, there was lots of publicity about them, and they used to do lots of experimental flights, and the fact that the Zeppelin was, although it had lots of flaws, it was huge. It could carry lots of people, lots of weapons, bombs, and it could fly great distances as well. In comparison, the aeroplanes of that time were really flimsy, you know, were nothing more than canvas and wood. And they just had, at first they only could use rifles before they fitted machine guns to them, and they couldn't really carry many bombs. And worst of all, in Britain, we didn't really have any military program to develop aircraft. They were mainly developed by private individuals. The War Office would just buy aircraft developed by individuals or small companies. You know, we didn't have a great production facility like Count von Zeppelin had. It was sponsored by the German government. And so a lot of the media would, newspapers of the time would show these great pictures of a German Zeppelin that would fill the whole page, and then show a picture of a British airship or aircraft, which looked like a little, you know, flying comparison, you know. So there was that fear that, I think another factor was the British Empire had been run by the, run and protected by the Royal Navy, and so the old thing that Britain was no, you know, could no longer be regarded as a fortress island, you know, the Germans could leap over the channel now with their aircraft and just attack us, and it changed the old shape of warfare, basically. By having aircraft, you no longer had any front lines. You know, civilians were as vulnerable to attack as people on the front line. So there were lots of implications about, you know, what aircraft or airships could do to in a war. So obviously, in the pre-war years, there were quite a few what we call now phantom airship scares. In Britain, there were these scares in 1909 and 1913. And at the end of 1912, what was thought to have been a German Zeppelin was heard over Sheerness. And that caused questions to be asked in the House of Commons. And Winston Churchill, who was, I think he was the First Lord of the Admiralty at the time, he was very keen on advocating defences against aerial attack, because at that time there weren't any really good resources to fight aircraft. Guns had to be developed to shoot down aircraft, you know, to get a better, you know, they needed to be elevated into the sky, and we had to get searchlights and other equipment to actually to shoot down aircraft at night. So he's very keen to develop systems and defences against aerial attack. So he kind of used the sightings in Sheerness to try and get more funding and more public awareness of the threat from the air. And that kind of triggered off more sightings in the early part of 1913 in England. And also, there were similar scares in New Zealand and Australia in 1909, which, in a way, they're a bit more hard to explain because, you know, they're obviously quite remote from Germany. But the rumours there was that a German warship was launching airships at night. So, in a way, with it being part of a British Empire at that time, obviously the fears that had been arisen in the press and media spread as far as Australia. And in America, there was actually an airship scare at the end of 1909. But rather than being triggered by the fear of Germans, that was triggered by revelations by an inventor called Tillinghast, who said he'd flown from somewhere like Boston to New York and back again in one night. But his stories were quite incredible. About he said he could fly quite long distances at night, and he said he could, you know, stop the aircraft and repair it and fly on again. And with his stories, lots of people then saw lights in the sky that they thought was his invention. And reporters were tracking him all day long to see if he'd disappeared to his secret aircraft base, you know, so that we could see if he was actually going to go out to fly that night or whatever. So it was quite a different scenario in America, where it, you know, the enthusiasm about creating the aircraft by secret inventors was more prominent than fear of how it might be attacking and spying on the land. So, but it just shows that there was this frame of mind of seeing lights in the sky. You know, it could be something like Venus or Mars, or it could be. I think another thing, because if there was any media attention, it also brought into play pranksters who would send up balloons with lights attached to them, or send up kites with lights to them as well. So even then, you had, and also people hoaxing, and there were journalistic hoaxes as well. So I think that's what attracted me to the subject originally. I thought, oh, it wouldn't be contaminated by a view of flying saucers or aliens. But if you go back in time, people had other things that kind of contaminated the sightings in terms of how it was reported, or you know, the old bugbear of misidentifications if people are honest, or the fact that, you know, there could be hoaxes and fakes. And I think another problem with a lot of these scares before the war were reported in newspapers, and they're not always known for the accuracy. You know, they obviously just published with the basic information, so often they can be a bit scanty on detail, really. So, but it's just a fascinating area of research, really, because you find out so much about what people, you know, what was on people's minds at the time. And obviously this was a sort of cutting-edge technology, so people didn't know what to expect. You know, what would, you know, airships dominate? You know, would we all be flying in huge zeppelins, or would we, you know, or would aircraft dominate the scene? And, you know, how would they, you know, people saw, if they did see objects, they often saw things with flapping wings or rotors, or, you know, all sorts of incredible things that couldn't be possible, but, you know, were obviously inspired by, you know, magazine articles, and also at the time there were quite a few you know, speculative stories about the future of flight and things like that. So there's quite a few things that could actually trigger these sightings and promote them. And like I said, Winston Churchill used these sightings to encourage defences against them, you know, German airships. And I think it's interesting, though, that even at that time or years earlier, there was a massive phantom airship scare throughout the United States from 1896 to 97. And there again, a lot of these sightings were attributed to German inventors or people with German origins. And Germans have always been associated with, you know, superior technology. So you can see where, you know, developing, say, flying saucers in the Second World War, it wasn't just something that came out of the blue. You know, there was this evolutionary idea of German aerial superiority.
Well, these things that were sighted in the United States in the 1890s, was that something that later on would look exactly like modern-day aircraft from the Nazis or any of the other allies, anything like that, that they could say, well, obviously it was a testing of this because here we know that this is exactly what we saw at that time?
I think with that particular scare, it was just, there were literally hundreds of accounts, and people actually said they encountered these craft. But a lot of the stories are they don't all match up. But a lot of them, you know, relate to strange aircraft landing, and they speak to the occupants and say they've come up with some, you know, a great new gas propellant that will keep the thing flying. Or let's say we've got these marvelous, you know, rotors or propellers that operate the craft. Some of them are almost like helicopters, and others are like zeppelins or airships, or others are like aircraft with, you know, flapping wings. So we've all got these strange, you know, wings and propellers and rotors and things. But obviously at that time, people weren't really used to aircraft. So in a way, we could interpret if somebody landed a helicopter in those days, you know, you'd probably get lots of different descriptions because people weren't familiar with these craft, and often they were seen at night time. And some, I think some people think there were actual inventors involved with this thing, which wouldn't surprise me because people were messing about with balloons and airships and motors. So, you know, some of them could have been created, but a lot of the sightings are of craft that have got far better capabilities than anything that you could even fly today. So, there's that sort of ambiguity, really. I think you'd have to sort of try to. It's really hard to pin it down because, obviously, over the years, all you can do is look at the newspaper accounts, really. And I think there again, there's quite a few journalistic hoaxes. You know, there's a story of the airship crashing into a windmill, recovering a body of a Martian pilot in Texas. And that story, some people still believe that some pilot was recovered. But there again, it was very likely to have been a journalistic hoax. But, you know, like I say, it's hard to pin down over the decades, really.
Well, in that case, though, that was in, I think, the 1890s as well, wasn't it, that yeah, case took place long before that kind of craft would have been up in the air. And the strange part of that story is, though, how protective the people of the town have been, and that there were accounts of people that had come into contact with the craft and the strange things that had, everything from bloating hands and strange cancers to them hiding the body and actually moving the headstone for the creature numerous times. It seems like if it was a hoax by a journalist, that got the entire town in on it.
I think what seems to happen is quite interesting, really, is a lot of these scares, not just airship ones, but even flying saucer scares, is they're often triggered by a very good sighting. And then you get other people saying they've seen something similar. Then you get somebody saying, oh, it was I was flying a kite or I launched a balloon. And then you get an explanation. And then that kind of trips the bubble and then people sort of forget about it. But like you say, a lot of these cases have a lot more detail and information, which undermines the sort of explanation that that kind of makes people forget about them and go on to the next sort of new sensation.
And, the creatures that were being seen at the time, the pilots of these craft, were they ever described as what we know as the modern day grays, the, you know, large bulbous heads, big eyes, or is that something that just really kind of started in the 1940s?
No, actually, a lot of the airships of that period, except the pilots were Oriental, so there's this association, you know, with people with Oriental humanoids, really, with Oriental period. And often, we were associated with sort of some were of Germans. They always said they had sort of guttural speech, which sounded German. So even then, the pilots were, or inventors were often associated with foreigners, basically. You know, I suppose we today would probably interpret more in terms of greys or aliens, really. In a way, a lot of the those cases as well, the encounters, are very much like the sort of contactee stories of the 1950s, where, you know, people said they encountered humanoids, you know, like George Adamski's Orphan, with, you know, the androgynous humanoids with long hair who could be, you know, male or female. And so in a way, you know, people did report self-occupants of these craft.
Were there any reports during that time then, during World War One or prior, of what we currently know now as alien abductions?
Well, the most famous one was that supposed to have taken place in Turkey, where in sort of August 1915, several hundred British troops were said to have gone up to the top of Hill 60, and then apparently a large cloud came over the hill, and then when the cloud went away, the soldiers disappeared as well. And that sort of got into a lot of the UFO literature, and it's quite an intriguing story, because there again, it's a mixture of a lot of different elements, really, because in the official records there was a cloud in that area, but it was actually seen reported the day after that apparent disappearance of the troops. And also it's more than likely that the troops just disappeared into the woods, and a lot of them were actually, you know, shot and buried and weren't really found until several years after the First World War. But it's quite interesting that even, and also the story didn't really arise until sort of like 50 years after the alleged event, really. But it's still quite intriguing that, people think there might have been an abduction of so many people by a sort of giant cloud-like UFO back during the First World War. So, but I think generally, you know, I think that's a problem, though, like I was saying about the Red Baron story. These are sort of retrospective accounts, so they're not really as good as anything you can find in the public records office or in the papers of a period, at least they're contemporary. Whereas the problem is now is that people have, you know, the flying saucer point of view, really. So anything ambiguous from the past can be interpreted, you know, in terms of the
exactly.
Now. So
Nigel Watson, our guest, will open up phone calls if you have questions for our guest. His new book, UFOs of the First World War, Phantom Airships, Balloons, Aircraft, and Other Mysterious Aerial Phenomena. I am your host, Dave Schrader, and you're listening to Coast to Coast AM.